All right, I need you to explain to me the man that you saw in very, very specific detail.
Okay. Yeah, he stands out pretty prominently to me. So he had very prominent green eyes.
Okay.
He had big, bushy eyebrows. He had a little bit of hair in between those eyebrows that kind of like seemed like a little bit of a unibrow.
Okay.
He didn't look like he plucked much, so they're kind of scraggly. He had pretty full lips.
Kissable?
I guess they could be kissable. Okay. They're pretty big.
Understood.
You know, like more of a thicker, like upper lip, you know, okay. Not that thin.
Okay.
He had a little bit of a scraggly beard. He had long sort of blonde hair, kind of like Richard Branson hair, you know? Does that make sense?
Yep.
Yeah. And he had a little bit of a cut, it looked like, that was just under his left eye, around his cheek.
Okay.
He had some splotching around his nose, and a little bit of kind of like some bulbous, kind of, you know, his nose was kind of bulbous on the end, and it looked like it was kind of pockmarked a bit. Yeah.
All right.
That's kind of what
I
remember.
Is this your guy?
That's a stick figure. Are you qualified? Who are you? Are you with the police?
Hello!
Hello!
And welcome to
Homegrown Horror.
For a sound suppressed.
Yeah, I think I.
Episode.
I think I did it. I'm Bea, co-host.
I'm Jackson, co-host. If you've been following the show for a while, you know that. Our audio has improved over the years, but there's definitely more room for improvement.
Yes, and it's been an ebb and a flow over some time, especially since, like, I realized that some of the things that were helping, I had moved. Like, I have a dress form in the corner that's usually, like, has clothes on it, and so that actually deadens the sound.
Yeah.
So I put that back, and I got curtains. I have beautiful curtains now.
It's fucking gorgeous. I love the curtain rods. So yeah, we're just talking about like studio setup is something that we've struggled with. We're not like sound engineers by trade, but we know that clothes and blankets on things helped. And it's kind of funny to think of like early when we started this, we were literally throwing blankets on your furniture. And now we're at a point where it's like we have sound panels. I think this curtain is helping.
I think so too.
I'm sure we'll listen to the audio and be like, oh, well, there's still a little echo, but even just being in the room, it's kind of like, it's a bit quieter in here.
It is way quieter.
Yeah.
But it's definitely been a journey for Homegrown Horror, which is a Maine spooky podcast about Maine spooky things.
Oh, yeah.
I forgot to say that. I said I was a co-host. I forgot to mention what we're co-hosting.
We're the sound engineer
This podcast. Is the sound engineer podcast. I mean, you say we're not sound engineers by trade, but I got an A in my sound design class.
Oh, good for you.
I mean, that was for like theater, so I don't know how to do it in a more domestic setting.
I mean, like, it probably just applied the principles you learned in the black box to here, and it's pretty much the same, right?
Same thing.
Yeah.
Completely the same.
Completely the same.
Oh.
Summer's winding down. It's gone fast.
It has gone really fast. We're already in August, and I can't believe it, because it's just, like, also, like, time has been, like, fast slow for me.
Yeah.
Because there are some, like, this past week has felt really, really long because I haven't really been able to sleep super well. And it's just, like, a lot of tech stuff. We are coming into a Mercury retrograde, for those of you who care about that bullshit. I do.
So, oh, that's what I heard the other day.
Yeah, so if you're having a lot of issue, if you're having a lot of issues with technology, and you are also like that normally don't happen, and also you're have, you know, lots of miscommunication happening, and you're like, but I thought I was being really precise, and like there's no way that this could be misconstrued, but it is being misconstrued. Mercury's not your friend right now.
I feel like that could just apply to every like week of my life. Is there a miscommunication breakdown at some point? Of course there is.
So
mostly featured on this podcast, they're well documented breakdowns.
Oh yeah, it's not as hot as it was before, which is nice. Like, it was like super nice this week. Yesterday we had a lot of rain, which was like, hello. But that made it very conducive for me to not want to go out and do things, but to sit home and do my notes for the podcast.
Oh boy. And so what do we have for today?
I'm changing gears because July was my history month. I did a lot of historical stuff, did a couple hauntings, did some, you know, Professor B is now on sabbatical, and we're going back to some murders.
Woo!
I was taking a look because before I started the podcast, I saved the main unsolved crimes database.
Yeah.
So I cracked that open, and I went through a couple cases.
Dust off that bad boy.
I went through a couple cases, and I ended up here.
Interesting.
And this is one of those moments where you have to take a pause, and you're like, how the fuck did I, A, not hear about this? B, like, we don't, like, it's not super well known. It looks like the only podcast that's actually done an episode on it is Murder, She Told.
Well, of course.
And there's, I love Murder, She Told. But
she notices us sometimes.
Sometimes. Hi. And I was just sort of blown away. There's a lot of resources, but a lot of them share the same information. So, but one of the things I wanted to do first and foremost is to give out a shout out to Dale Mower, who is the nephew of the victim, Effie McDonald. He maintains the Bangor House murder blog, and he compiles old articles, information, and other items pertaining to the case. It hasn't been updated since 2010, but it's still a very effective resource for information on Effie's case. And I really wanted to just thank him for the work that he's done, because a lot of the information and quotes from older articles, which are all mostly from Bangor Daily News, because it takes place in Bangor, they were pulled from his collection. So he's done a lot of work. Deep appreciation for him before we move on.
A lot of good research, solid evidence.
Super, he's more like collecting. And so,
okay,
so gotcha. You know how you've mentioned how difficult it is to find old articles.
Yeah. He's collected them.
He's collected them and put them there for people to have easy access to.
Super appreciated.
Yeah. Because if you want older articles, typically you have to go to like newspapers.com, and it's a very expensive endeavor.
They did give me my money back though after one free trial. Like, I accidentally like
let it roll over,
and I was like, oh, there's a big charge here. And I was like, hey, can you please take that off? And they're like,
I know. newspapers.com is I think now affiliated with Ancestry, and I used to have an Ancestry account, but I got rid of my subscription because it's like $169 for 6 months.
That's insane.
And when you're not, like, when I was actively using it, I was like, sure, that's fine.
Why is it such a high and sexy number?
Oh, right. So, take a deep breath, because this is going to be a time. I do want to, content warning. There's a little bit of sexual assault and rape stuff mentioned. If you're not cool with that, highly recommend, like, piecing out. There's not a whole lot of it, but it's there.
It's a sprinkle.
Effie McDonald was one of eight children of George and Daisy Terrell. She was born in 1911 in Holton, you know, up in Aroostook, our favorite place. Her family moved to Bangor in the 1930s, but by the time Effie got married, she and her husband actually moved back to Holton, where she lived until their divorce in the 1950s. The couple didn't have any children, so Effie was able to pick up her bags and make her way back to Bangor so she could be closer to her family. She had most of her, I mean, she has eight siblings, them and their families, her mother, they're all in Bangor. So she just picks up and goes right back to where she left off, rejoining the community And by 1965, she took up residence in a small apartment on Boynton Street and began, oh, sorry, 1956, sorry. I mixed my numbers. She took up residence in a small apartment on Boynton Street and began working at Quality Bakery. At some point, the bakery closed and she found new employment with the Bangor House, which is a very, at the time, was a very prominent hotel. This is where people went to stay. There is information out there on the Bangor House, but this is not about the Bangor House, so if you want more information on it, you can do your research. Effie was, by all accounts, a woman of simple means. Her sister, Avis Mower, and her husband, Frank Mower, remember her as being a quiet homemaker type, never drinking, smoking, or swearing, and she found joy in creating, preferring to spend her time knitting and crocheting. Her family knew her to be a helpful and caring presence, and she was always there to offer a helping hand. Effie's landlady, Miss Jacks, recalled her as being kind and pleasant, and she told the Bangor Daily News in 1965, quote, "She was a woman who didn't go out much. Her only visitors, as far as I know, were members of her immediate family. She kept more or less to herself, and on Sundays she would clean her room and probably listen to the radio or watch television," unquote. So Effie's just a very...
very chill. Very...
super chill to herself. She's just living her life.
Yeah.
In a very, you know, she's got that, I don't know, like this warm quality is what I get when I hear, you know.
Yeah, yeah. She sounds like a very chill individual, mm-hmm. you know, not very, not out there to harm anybody, no inflated ego.
She just effed
down to earth.
Yeah. March 18th, 1965 started like any other for Effie. She began her 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. shift at the Bangor House, where she was a chambermaid. Around 2 p.m.
Damn, those are some nice hours.
Those are great hours. Those are some great hours.
I hope that paid well.
I think being a chambermaid, my sister used to work in hotels, and like at least nowadays, like it's a very physically demanding job.
Dude, yeah, they have to like, they put a lot of effort into every single room.
And she's seen a lot of gross shit.
Dude, yeah.
Yeah. I can't say that it was that way then, but definitely a very, this is a great shift to be working, I think.
Hopefully respectable guests as well, you know.
I mean, yeah. Well, around 2 p.m., sure. Effie's supervisor realized none of her coworkers had seen her since 12:30. She'd been doing routine chores before seemingly disappearing. Discontent set in, thinking maybe their colleague, who was a known asthmatic, may have had a medical emergency without any of them knowing. They began searching for her at their supervisor's direction. Unfortunately, the truth was much more horrifying than they could have ever conceived. It wasn't long before a fellow chambermaid had entered a vacant room on the third floor of the hotel, a room that had been empty for over 2 days, thinking that nothing would be amiss here. She wasn't going to find Effie. It was just going to be an empty room. Instead, she found Effie's badly beaten remains.
Oh, my goodness.
Half-dressed, raped, and strangled with a nylon stocking.
Oh, my goodness.
She was only 54 years old.
And nobody heard this. No, this is awful.
Yeah, nobody.
No one knew.
No.
Yeah.
And I think it's because one of the things that's always so, like, terrifying to me is, like, that this is at work. This is one of the places you're meant to be safe. And I know it's we've covered a couple things before. I can't remember the case, but one of the ones, it was another hotel.
Yeah. Similar kind of circumstance.
I don't know what it is about hotels in Maine. Like, those are the cases that we see where people, something bad happens to them at work. It's usually in hotels.
And also, this is like 1950s. This is cash only. This is
1965.
Still cash only. Like, untraceable. It's like, if this is an area where there's a lot of people kind of filtering in and out, like, people just got away with shit constantly back in the 60s, 70s, into the 80s, you mm-hmm. know? Just, like, constantly
and,
stealing
and we stuff. Also don't have DNA testing.
We don't have DNA testing
which,
at this time.
Yeah. The shockwaves from Effie's murder were felt immediately. All of her coworkers were stricken with shock and grief. one of the hotel switchboard operators named Sadie Bell actually collapsed after hearing the news and was admitted to Eastern Maine General Hospital and placed on the danger list per a report from Bangor Daily News on March 19th, 1965. So she ended up having like a cardiac event as a result of the shock. Avis and Frank, who are her sister and her brother-in-law, upon hearing about Effie's death, they rushed to the Bangor house but were held off by the police. As they pressed for details surrounding the murder, they were told, "You don't want to know."
Wow.
As details were gradually released, Avis and her sisters and her mother, Daisy, were sheltered from the full brunt of the truth. Her brothers did their best to protect them from the really gruesome details about the case. Effie's funeral was closed casket, and the family was pretty tight-lipped about their devastation. Avis recalled in a 2010 Bangor Daily News article that by not talking about Effie's death, quote, "You don't have to live through it again," unquote. She also noted, quote, "She would sometimes break down crying when she went by the Bangor house that had passed with the years, but her heart still aches whenever she sees the place. I have no desire to go there," she said. Her oldest son, Dale Mower, who was 5 at the time, also recalled in the same article, quote, "I remember her crying and screaming. It was hard then, and it still is. For most of my life, it was a pretty taboo topic of conversation in the family, but in the last few years, my mother has talked about it," unquote.
Yeah.
Which, that seems also pretty par for the course for the time period as well.
To, like, not talk about these kinds of issues. I think there's sort of, like, this weird provincial lifestyle of the small town where it's, like, you do focus on kind of keeping to yourself and not riling anything up or not try to make anybody else uncomfortable by your own personal problems, which is sad. That's not a community.
Yeah,
that's,
but that's I can also see where Avis is coming from and being, like, if you don't talk about it, you don't have to relive it. But then also it's one of those things where sometimes talking about it, like in therapy or something, you can slowly start to let...
You can process your
process
feelings.
Process it, but not let go, but process. Yeah,
you can get to I think really it just gets you to a point of acceptance, I suppose, of just like, this is what I feel, you know?
While the family grieved, the police immediately began working on the case, with Effie's murder being one of the worst murders in Bangor's history, and with the Bangor house being such a prominent location in town, they had a lot to contend with. There was significant media attention, rumors, and a killer on the loose, so there was little time to waste. Mm. They began by questioning over 100 guests at the hotel and compiled hundreds of typewritten pages into a coherent version of what occurred on March 18th, 1965. One of the pervasive rumors was that Effie's death may have been connected to the Boston Strangler. Are you familiar with this case at all?
I've heard of the Boston Strangler, but I haven't, like, perused the details of the Boston Strangler.
All right, I'm just going to give you a very high level. This is very high level. He was responsible for the murder of 13 women in the Boston area in the 1960s. I believe they have connected a person to it with posthumous DNA testing, but I just don't. This is not what this is about. But Ryan Robbins, keeper of BangorInfo.com, notes, quote, "Like the Strangler cases, McDonald had been raped and strangled with her own nylon stocking, but most of the Strangler victims were found in what some have called obscene poses, with their stockings knotted around their chin. Bangor authorities did not mention anything about the position McDonald's body was when she was found, and McDonald's stocking had not been tied in a knot around her chin. Massachusetts authorities visited the crime scene and examined the evidence, but reportedly determined there were enough discrepancies between the cases to conclude they were not committed by the same person. However, Massachusetts police did keep one detective on the Bangor House case, reportedly to help Bangor police draft a personality profile of the killer," unquote. So this was one of the big rumor. People were saying it has to be the Boston Strangler. Like, it has to be. And for those who are very wrapped up in true crime, you know that their personality profiles, looking at MOs, things like that, those are key to trying to figure out, like, the 13 cases from the Boston Strangler are also similar. So you can't just say, oh, because Effie was strangled with her nylon stockings, it's the same person.
Yeah, yeah. There's those slight differences. I mean, there are those differences among the MO and this that is unique enough to say.
And also the rest of them were in Boston. So this is, Bangor is pretty far away. And the person that I think that they have said is the Boston Strangler can be connected in the area.
Right.
So it is also outside of the MO to travel to Bangor to commit a crime.
So just unlikely.
Yeah. Which, unfortunate that now, like, that's Boston Strangler's off the table. The investigation, which
get out of here, Boston Strangler.
It was, the investigation was helmed by Detective Captain Clifton E. Sloan of the Bangor Police Department. He pushed on full steam. And they were able to narrow down those hundreds of accounts to one suspect. Their man had been a guest at the hotel with what people described as prominent brown eyes, and he had been seen slipping out of one of the hotel's back doors.
What, was he an anime character?
No.
Prominent brown eyes.
Prominent brown eyes.
That's so weird. They're just eyes. Why are they prominent? Are they bigger?
I don't know. I think maybe piercing.
It doesn't sound like...
I'm not sure what they mean by that. But they also put out a sketch, which I actually have. I can show you.
Show me the sketch.
So here's the sketch.
What a very average-looking man.
He's very average. He's quite average.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, they described him as having, like, a stocky build, 5 feet 10 inches height, brown hair, prominent brown eyes.
It's like a farm boy.
Kind of, yeah, I kind of get that vibe, absolutely. So they start putting out details, they put out this sketch, and they're like, we're looking for this man. I don't believe they put out a name, but they had a person in mind.
So they actually guy, had... And they were like, and then they let everybody go on their merry ways? What?
No. Uh-huh. Nope. Okay. So they put out information, uh-huh, and said man immediately hired an army of lawyers.
Wow.
Which made him virtually unreachable with the amount of evidence or lack thereof, because DNA testing wasn't a thing. And also the clues left at the scene weren't enough to support guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. So...
It'd been really funny if you showed me the police sketch and it was like Grimace.
So I mean, he looks like the human equivalent of Grimace.
Like the human equivalent of Grimace, yeah.
I also believe, because I looked at some of the comments on the Bangor House murder blog, and there are some people that say things, but again, those are rumors. That's hearsay. I'm not bringing it into it. So I don't know this man's name.
Reading your comments, but you can find them.
You can find them and see what people believe / are saying. In 1971...
I'm sorry.
In 1971, Bob Taylor wrote for News City Desk, which was then later published in the Bangor Daily News, quote, the fragile web of facts unsupported by witnesses or important physical evidence would melt under the weight of legal doubt in a courtroom. Sloan believed that he had enough evidence to obtain an indictment from a grand jury, but finally decided against it. If the suspect should be arrested and freed after a superior court trial, he would be forever beyond reach of the law. Police decided to wait and hope for a break. That was 6 years ago, and the final solution to the case seems further away than ever. Sloan admits that there isn't much chance that new evidence will come to light at this late date. However, he still believes that the killer could make a slip. Sloan's theory is that the crime was the result of an emotional outburst. He believes the killer attacked the chambermaid because he was dissatisfied with the room. If the killer is truly a person given to such emotional tantrums, Sloan theorizes, he could blow his top at any minute and commit another serious crime. Perhaps next time he wouldn't be so lucky. On the other hand, Sloan believes 6 years of living with the crime might weigh heavily upon the killer's conscience. There may come a time where he will want to confess, unquote.
Bullshit.
Also,
if he's describing a guy who's flipping his lid over a room not being clean, he's not going to fucking care about confessing.
I also don't know about that either, because they, like, it was pretty clear in the doc, like, all of the articles and documents that I read, that nobody had been in that room, and also they would have, like, they would be able to look at the hotel guest book or whatever and, like, say, oh, yes, we put this person in this room today.
Yeah.
That's, and maybe they do have that, and they just aren't saying it plain, but that's not on the list of evidence that is widely known. So
that's got to be there. That record has to be
there.
Like,
I do also want to note Bob Taylor, the guy that wrote this article in 1971.
1971, okay.
I have a bone to pick with him. Because he said, quote, Effie McDonald, quiet and not especially attractive, was the unlikely victim of a crime of passion, unquote. Fucking rude.
Bob Taylor, what the fuck, dude?
Because also, I feel like now we know that it's like crime specifically sexual crimes. It doesn't matter what you're wearing, doesn't matter what you look like.
Yeah.
It doesn't. And so maybe that's just 1971 brain talking, but I was just sort of like,
That is
fucking rude.
That is Bob Taylor. You gotta stop listening in on the conversations in the locker, buddy.
Like, oh my god, I was just like, what the fuck? Because, you know, I'm reading, like, all these people have such nice things to say about her, and he's like, she's not especially attractive.
Bob Taylor's looking at the fucking crime scene photos, and he's going, pass.
Yeah, that's what it feels like. It doesn't. With everything else fucking going rude, on, Bob. I'm like, this did not need to be a comment that was made.
What's your problem, Taylor?
For real. In any event, Sloan and his team's hands were tied. Even back in 2010, Avis was doubtful that her sister's killer would be brought to justice. Quote, I don't think it will ever be solved, not after all this long time. I know it will never go off the books, but I don't believe it will ever be solved, unquote. 58 years have passed since Effie's murder, and time has plodded along. The waves of time take with it the hope of closing the case. Jesse Ellison wrote for Down East, quote, Sloan died in 1976, but he spent the rest of his life claiming to know beyond a doubt the identity of McDonald's killer. And he reportedly revisited his case files often in hopes of finding something he may have missed. Like all unsolved homicide cases in Maine, McDonald's case is still listed as open, and members of the McDonald family, many of whom remain in Bangor, have said the man who was Sloan's main suspect is now deceased, unquote. So
we better go dig him up.
So the detective is dead, and so is the main suspect. The other thing that I forgot to put in my notes, but I also wanted to mention, because it was really sad, in this Bangor Daily News article, it had mentioned that they actually have a lot of her family, Avis's family, the Mowers, have kept a lot of Effie's crafting projects, including a red sweater that she had been working on for her niece. And that just made me really, the whole thing is sad, but that just was like, it really, really hurt.
That is sad.
It's incredibly sad, and it is one of those cases. I think as time has gone on, like, the list, like, there's only set, like, right currently, when I looked at the list of unsolved homicides in Maine, there's only 75.
Yeah.
She's one of them. We've covered a couple of the other ones as well, like,
we kept a couple prominent ones for sure. Yeah.
And this is one of the oldest. I think that Daniel Wood Jr.,
Daniel K. Wood Jr.
Yes.
Yeah.
That is currently the oldest on the list that I was looking at. So, you know, which was still only like in the 60s, 50s, 60s, 70s. Like, we're slowly, you know, that the caseload is slowly either dropping off, or we're, solving them to a reasonable degree. But it's really sad, because, like, as time goes on, it is sort of like I said, is like raw, like, waves washing away, taking everything, you know, the people are passing on, the evidence is rotting in a locker somewhere probably, and it's
next to someone's misplaced skull. Yeah.
Yes. So it's, this case was incredibly sad. And again, this is one of those things where I'm like, how did I never hear of this? Why aren't there more people that have discussed this case? And I know it's also hard talking about some of these cases too, because there's just so little information left. But yeah, this was really nice that, I think because it's in Bangor, Bangor Daily News has, you know, in 2010, they reached out to the family to kind of do a check-in. But that's, 2010 is really the last time anybody besides Murder, She Told has talked about this.
This is really, this is a big one. I actually remember reading this case through the Unsolved files before, and I was I'm going to leave this one alone. I just don't feel good about them. But this one's really rough, and it's kind of insane that we have so much confidence, or Sloan had so much confidence in who the killer was. So, speculation time. Obviously, this guy is rich.
Probably.
Yeah, because it's like team of lawyers. That's expensive. And he kept it up. That's very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Never get his name out. This guy is traveling in the area.
He must have been. Yeah, because I don't know if he's from the area. Like, that's not clear. Yeah. Again, that's something that the police probably know, have had on file. But
I think that if he lived in the area, there would be a lot more about him out there already.
Like, and I said, some of the comments on the Bangor House Murder blog named some names.
Okay.
Again, I don't have confidence in that.
Uh-huh.
Because, again, it's rumors. I'm not from the area. I don't feel like I have the right to say yay or nay on any of it.
Right,
so
right.
That information is out there if you know, because I know that's, we've run into that issue before, because there was a time where I did a whole thing on Jeremy Alex, and it is a lost episode because I went way too deep into the rabbit hole of like local speculation and rumors, and
it was not an episode that we felt comfortable releasing.
Absolutely. And so that's why I'm very careful about, like, that information's out there if you're interested in looking at it, but it's not something that I can speak with confidence on.
Yeah.
What we know is the suspect is dead. His mm-hmm. name has never been publicly released, which that's also crazy that it's like, because I feel like a lot of times when people die, they are able to say, well, this person was a suspect. There were other suspects that there were about 30 people in relation to the crime that were questioned further. They were all released. And then after that is when they were like, this is our guy.
Mm-hmm.
That guy, I don't know if they ever actually spoke to him or if he lawyered up. But when they were like, hey, can we talk to you? He was like, no.
Nope.
Yeah. So, and runs that's, away. And I think that's what's crazy is, like, some people get a lawyer and then we'll talk to police. He got a lawyer so he wouldn't.
He got a team of lawyers, so apparently. He wouldn't.
Yeah, because
so no one can
a lot of articles use the word barricaded himself behind lawyers.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, that's intense.
That is intense.
Do you need that many lawyers? Like, that's the thing, is do you need that many lawyers?
That's the thing, is like, it's gotta be someone who is really rich.
I have confidence that Sloan probably had the right person, and it's just unfortunate that with the legal red tape, and also, like, we've talked about a little bit about the like how court works, how the legal system works, is that, like, if you do take somebody, they get indicted, like, their double jeopardy is a thing. You are, like, if you don't have it, like, perfect, sometimes you are taking a huge risk if you do have the right person.
Mm-hmm.
And I think her family is still in the Bangor area. I'm not sure if her sister-in-law and brother-in-law, Avis and Frank Mower, I don't know if they're still alive. You know, because the article that I pulled from where they were interviewed was from 2010.
Right.
So it's been 13 years.
Yeah, it's been a minute.
It's one of those things where, like, And like I said, her nephew also hasn't updated the blog in a long time either.
Yeah.
But I only wish them the best. And again, thank you to Dale Mower for compiling all of that stuff. It makes it a lot easier for people to like find the information in a place where a lot of the stuff, like a lot of the stuff that I found were sort of those compiled things, you know, from like only in your state or, you know, unsolved or whatever, where it's just the bare minimum, like bare bones.
Yeah, not very helpful.
Listicle.
We usually use that as sort of like a
jumping off point.
Yeah, and then we'll research.
And
more.
That's what happened here. It was a jumping off point because I was actually researching Judith Hand's murder.
Yeah.
Which, not a lot of information. Maybe we'll do that someday, but there's just absolutely nothing. Another awful unsolved murder, but it's like sometimes with those, there's just nothing. This one.
It's true.
I really appreciate all the work that her nephew has done to make sure that that information just doesn't disappear.
I hear you.
Yeah.
I hear you.
And that's the story of the murder of Effie McDonald.
Oh, boy. What a fun time this was.
Wow. It's...
I think the suspect is dead. I think you can still face justice. You get me the Necronomicon.
Well, like I said, with the Boston Strangler.
They did a full investigation conclusion to
who it was.
Yeah, cuz
they did similar to what they with the Golden State Killer case where
yeah.
they were able to find somebody who had similar DNA because you can you know, when you submit your DNA to like 23andMe or Ancestry, you can say like, hey, you can use this. And so I believe that's what happened. They were able to find someone who was linked and they're like, wow, that's very similar. So then they exhumed this man and were able to link him to at least one of the crimes.
Right.
That's why I also don't want to like label his name with Boston Strangler. Again, that information's out there. This is also not, I want to focus on Effie the best I can.
Yeah. No, yeah. Well, the only other reason then leads me to believe this guy is like ultra rich is the fact that there isn't some post death follow up.
Oh yeah.
Mini investigation to say, hey, we really think it's this guy, because that does happen. That's happened in other cases.
He probably has like, there's probably a lot of red tape around his estate.
That's what I'm saying is like the family doesn't want that shit coming out.
Yeah, they are probably. Upkeep it like to an intense degree. Like we haven't heard, like there just isn't anything. I think it's really it's crazy to me too because it seems like for a little while
was it Bezos?
I don't think so. It doesn't look like Bezos.
Oh, okay. That was like before.
And maybe we're due for the Bangor Daily News to revisit it, and we're putting this out before that because it looks like every 10, 15 years, they kind of revisit the case. Okay. I really hope that they do because, you know, we have crazy technology now. So it would be wonderful if we could figure something out. Because I don't think that it's totally impossible. There have been cases where they said it's impossible and they've cracked it. I don't think it's completely out of the realm to say.
I don't think it's out of the realm for someone to write a book with all the evidence and then let people pretty much decide.
Like Michelle,
hey, this
like,
totally happened.
Like Michelle McNamara did for the Golden State Killer.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I feel like we should scrub this. We should write the book.
No. But, yep, that's my story.
That's my story.
That's my story.
Well, thank you very much, B, for sharing this. You know, and, I mean,
you gonna pivot?
Gonna try. Hey, it's the next mainism.
I was gonna say, you know what else? You know, the Bangor House was a very prominent hotel. You know what else was a very prominent thing?
Hey, it's a mainism. It's not your best, but that's okay.
No, that one's not. It wasn't as bad. Last week's was better.
Last week was better. You know. But that's pretty much what I do. It's like, hey, you know what's also is a thing? Yeah. So today we're going to be talking about a famous structure known far and wide throughout the southern region of southern Maine.
The southern region of
southern Maine. So just in southern Maine, southern region of Maine, is a prominent, well, specifically a city. Shut the fuck up, phone. Just because I took you up doesn't give you the opportunity. Yeah, it's like, oh, I can chime in. I'm here too.
I'm here. It's me. Your phone.
It's your phone.
We're going to talk about the time and temperature building.
That's... Yeah, thank you very much. The time and temperature building, also known originally as the Chapman Building, which is on 477 Congress Street in Portland, Maine. It's a 14-story office building. Very exciting. It is named after a large three-sided four-element egg crate display screen, which is on the top of the roof that flashes the local time and temperature, hence giving it the name the Time and Temperature Building. And
I think we also mentioned the Time and Temperature Building in the Joe Bornstein Mainism. Yes. Because it will say, call Joe.
So that is the thing. Like, now it's just a Joe Bornstein, like, advertisement screen. But it does display some sort of interesting information a little bit. It used to be, so this building has been built up over the years. It used to be 12 stories. Now it's 14. Used to be like home to a shopping center, but now it's really just office space. Developers did buy it up actually recently, 2018, yes, for like $9.3 million or something. And there is talk right now in converting the space into a luxury hotel.
Because we need more of those.
Yes, we're desperately running low on hotels and not affordable apartments. We definitely need another fucking hotel. Because that's the only thing we actually care about is taking other people's money, not sustaining the people that actually fucking live here.
Nope. And I did see, because we had discussed it, because I saw on Facebook that the Time and Temperature Building went dark the other day, but you said you thought you saw it lit up yesterday.
I think it probably went dark for a little bit.
So, but, yeah. Don't know how, don't know why, but it was the... There was a lot of speculation about what the hell was going on, including that it was just going to be quietly phased out was a rumor that was going around, which I do not know if it's lit up again today, maybe. But I know that they had mentioned that they weren't moving forward yet with hotel plans because of the labor shortage.
Yeah.
So.
Well, apparently it was sold at auction. So it wasn't even like a listing. It was just sold at auction.
Interesting.
Which makes sense. $9.3 million is like, you know, I guess a low number for a big fucking building.
I think so.
You know? Yeah. And apparently it needs a lot of work, honestly. Yeah. So that's the thing that's like kind of...
I think the only thing that still works in that building is probably the sign.
Honestly, yeah. So that's kind of why we're sort of in this weird like limbo right now of like, is it going to be built into a hotel or something else? Build apartments! But
yeah, please, they're build trying apartments. To yeah, build apartments.
They're trying to figure out now like what's going to make sense to use it, because it does need significant investment. So as we mentioned before, it does flash like a Joe Bornstein advertisement. Also during big snow emergencies in the city, it will flash park ban to remind people not to park on the street.
There's always a park ban when it snows.
Yeah, there's always a parking ban. It triggers pretty easily.
Did I tell you? I think I've mentioned it on the podcast. So in 2015, Snowmageddon occurred.
Yeah.
Okay. And it hit most of New England. But it was so bad that where the place that, like, when they move, when they do snow removal,
yeah,
the area that they move it to, there was so much snow that it interfered with airplanes coming into the jetport.
Holy crap. That's so wild.
It is very wild.
At
least that's the word on the street. I cannot confirm nor deny, but that's what everyone says.
So a little bit of interesting history for you, B, because I thought this was cool. So you know that there's like no billboards, basically, throughout the entirety of Maine. So Maine law prohibits flashing messages on signs visible from state highways. Well, the Time and Temperature Building is visible from state highways. It's visible from Peaks Island. But in 1991, the Maine legislature passed a grandfather clause exemption to allow the Time and Temperature Building to use advertising to cover operating costs. So that
it's just Joe Bornstein.
It's just Joe Bornstein. He's the main moneymaker. apparently there was a replacement of the sign before as well.
Makes sense.
It also advertises WMTW News.
Oh, yeah. Which that makes sense.
So there's the two things it advertises.
Yeah, which I think would be enough to cover operating costs.
Obviously. Yeah, enough to cover the sign. Perfect. So that's our little mainism, the time and temperature building. A nice little, a solid beacon.
It is a solid in the old beacon. Port.
The lighthouse for the people.
Oh, that's what we're calling it.
For the moths to the flame.
Drawing us all to Portland, Maine.
And Joe Bornstein.
Well, thank you all again for joining us for today's episode. If you have questions or comments or just want to share some stories, if you have an idea for a Mainism, reach out to us at homegrownhorrorpod@gmail.com or reach out to us on Instagram, where we are slowly becoming more active again. We've got more stuff going up at homegrownhorrorpod. And
you can comment on this episode on Spotify down below.
That's a new thing.
Mm-hmm. We didn't choose that. That just started happening.
Nope. And then we got a little shout out from Macabre Family, where she said she loved the episode with Jeff.
Yes!
So, hi, Steph!
Hi, Steph! Oh, my God. We need to talk to Steph.
It's been a while.
We need to chat with Steph. Like, I remember when we first started, we were like, oh, we'd love to hang.
I still would love to hang, but life
just never fucking happened.
Life gives you lots of lemons, and it takes a long time to make that lemonade.
Let's make lemons together.
You can also leave us a review or some stars on Apple Podcasts, but, you know, we're just really happy that you're here, so thank you once again, and we will see you all in the next episode.
Bye.